Tune in for tales, words that set sail.
Digital splendor, literature illuminated.
Have you ever really thought about how you'd start an argument that's going to change the entire world? Well, in 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species, and he knew, he absolutely knew, he had a fight on his hands. So today, instead of trying to cover the whole theory of evolution, we're going to do something a little different. We are going to unpack the brilliant step-by-step argument that Darwin built right at the very start of his book. It's truly a masterclass in persuasion, and honestly, seeing how he builds his case is just as fascinating as the theory itself. So Darwin kicks things off by framing his entire quest. He's not just, you know, cataloging birds or looking at plants. He is tackling what he calls the mystery of mysteries, the origin of species. I mean, that single line sets an incredible stage, right? He's not just a scientist. He's basically positioning himself as a detective. And he's inviting us, the reader, to join him on this investigation into the greatest puzzle in the history of nature.
So where do you even start with a question that massive? You'd probably think he'd begin with some exotic fossils or maybe the famous finches from the Galapagos Islands. But Darwin, he was way more strategic than that. He chose a starting point that was almost disarmingly simple, something that anyone in Victorian England could understand and, you know, see with their own two eyes.
That's right. His very first clue came from home, from the farm, from the garden. He actually wrote that a careful study of domesticated animals and of cultivated plants would offer the best and safest clue to solving the problem. And this is just a brilliant move. Instead of starting with the wild and unfamiliar, which might seem totally alien to his readers, he begins with the tame, the known. It's this undeniable shared starting point for everyone.
And what was his first huge observation right here? It's this: domesticated life is incredibly diverse. He points out that all these cultivated plants and animals, they generally differ much more from each other than do the individuals of any one species in a state of nature. What he's basically doing is establishing a crucial fact right from the get-go. Under human influence, life isn't fixed. It's plastic. It's changeable. And that observation, that's the first critical piece of evidence for his entire argument.
And to make this point completely impossible to ignore, Darwin zooms in on just one creature, the domestic pigeon. And the variety he found was just, wow, it's astonishing. You got the English carrier with its long, imposing beak. Then there's the short-faced tumbler with a beak that's almost like a finch's. You got the pouter, which inflates its chest to these comical proportions, and the fantail, with this explosion of 30 or 40 tail feathers. I mean, they look like entirely different species.
But here is the knockout punch. Darwin, after doing a ton of research, keeping pigeons himself, talking to all the top breeders, he was, in his words, fully convinced that all these wildly different birds came from a single common ancestor, the humble wild rock pigeon. And if that much change was possible from just one starting point, well, it proved that species weren't these fixed, unchangeable things. Modification wasn't just possible, it was happening all around him.
Okay, so if this huge amount of variation is possible, the next logical question has to be, how? What's the mechanism? And this brings us to the second big step in his argument, man's power of selection.
So Darwin explained this process, which we now call artificial selection. He saw it as this simple but incredibly powerful feedback loop. It all starts with a little bit of random variation, you know, a pigeon with a slightly shorter beak or maybe a few extra tail feathers. Then the human breeder steps in and acts as the selecting force, choosing which traits they want to pass on. The key, though, is that over generations, this isn't just a small change. It's an accumulation of all those tiny changes that leads to these dramatic new forms.
Darwin even quotes this agricultural writer, Youatt, to show how potent this idea already was among the breeders themselves. They saw selection as a magician's wand, giving them the power to basically create new forms. This wasn't just some abstract theory he cooked up. It was a practical art that was visibly reshaping the living world right in front of everyone.
But Darwin realized the process was actually even more profound than that. It doesn't even have to be intentional. He describes what he calls unconscious selection, where people aren't even trying to create a new breed. They're just trying to keep their best animals. So by always breeding from the strongest dog, or the cow that produces the most milk, they are, over centuries, unconsciously changing the breed. It's this slow, invisible, but absolutely relentless force for change.
Okay, so at this point, Darwin has established two huge things: that great variation is possible, and that a process called selection is the cause. And now, he makes the single most important pivot in his entire opening argument. He takes the principle he found in the farmyard and applies it to all of nature.
He draws this perfect parallel
Under domestication, you have variation, which is then acted on by human selection, and the result is new breeds. So in nature, you also have variation, and the result is new species. But what is the driving force? What stands in for the human breeder? That question mark. That is the heart of the mystery he is about to solve.
He argues that two conditions are just constant out in the wild. First, just like on the farm, variation is everywhere. No two living things are exactly alike. And second, and this is the big one, every single organism is locked in what he calls a struggle for existence.
Now, Darwin didn't just invent this idea out of thin air. He's very clear that he's borrowing from the economist Thomas Malthus, who had argued that human populations tend to grow way faster than their food supply, which leads to this inevitable struggle. Well, Darwin realized this wasn't just about people. It was a universal law of all life.
So the crucial point boils down to this simple, kind of brutal math. An orchid can produce a million seeds, a single fish can lay thousands of eggs, but in most cases, only a tiny, tiny fraction will ever survive to reproduce themselves. This massive gap between how many are born and how many can actually survive guarantees constant competition, a struggle for resources, for mates, for life itself.
And with that, all the pieces are finally on the table. He has established that variation happens and that there is a constant struggle. Now, in the final part of his introduction, he puts them all together into its grand central argument.
And it's this beautiful, inescapable chain of logic. He starts with a simple premise. If slight variations naturally happen among individuals out there in the wild,
and if there is a constant struggle for existence where most individuals die before they can ever reproduce, then it just logically follows that any individual who happens to be born with even a slight variation that gives it an edge, a little bit better camouflage, maybe sharper claws, more resistance to drought, that individual will have a better chance of surviving and passing that very trait to its kids. In this huge struggle, the useful variations get preserved and the unhelpful ones get weeded out.
And this is his answer. He calls it natural selection. It's the driving force that fills in that question mark from before. There is no breeder. Nature itself is the selector, acting nonstop on every living thing all the time. It's like man's power of selection, but as he says, it's immeasurably superior, acting over millions and millions of years.
And with that, he states his conclusion for the entire book, right there in the introduction. He's fully convinced that species are not unchangeable and that natural selection is the main engine driving that change. It's such a bold, confident statement, but one that now feels completely earned, built piece by logical piece from his observations of a farmyard all the way to the laws of nature.
But what is truly amazing, and what really shows you the mind of a great scientist, is that this entire powerful argument was just his opening statement.
Throughout his introduction, Darwin keeps referring to his revolutionary 500-page book as merely an abstract. He actually apologized for not being able to include all his references and data, promising a much bigger book in the future. Now, this wasn't false modesty. It was a reflection of the absolute mountain of evidence he knew it would take to prove his case. What we just walked through, that wasn't the evidence itself. It was the logical framework he built to interpret all the evidence that was about to follow.
So just think about that journey for a second. In just a few pages, Darwin takes us from something as simple and familiar as breeding pigeons all the way to a universal law that governs all life on Earth. And he did it before he even presented a single fossil. So the question his first readers were left with, and the one we can still marvel at today, is if this is just the opening argument, what other profound evidence did he have waiting for us in the chapters to come?